PRI's podcasts and on-demand audio are free, thanks to contributions from listeners like you. Make a difference. Invest in better media. Contribute at PRI.org. Thank you.
Today in Studio 360, what is it about Mormons that's so perfectly, irresistibly musical theater? The Book of Mormon is up for 14 Tony Awards this weekend. I'll talk with Robert Lopez, the show's composer, about how he and the guys from South Park created a genuine masterwork.
The music expands a little bit, and then it kind of gets smacked down, and it goes back into this.
Turn it off!
And we'll go off-Broadway behind the scenes of another extremely ambitious new production. It's part theater, part dance, part theme park, all inspired by Macbeth.
How do we do the full Macbeth, but you don't hear any of the language? Ultimately, it's a silent film.
Plus, a new book that says TV entertainment is all about liberal brainwashing. I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today on the show, one of the most interesting, trippiest theater productions I've ever seen. It is this giant reimagining of Macbeth. And I mean giant. The stage is 100,000 square feet. We'll go behind the scenes with its creator. And later, a happening indie band called The Antlers play songs from their new album live here in our studio. But first, another season of primetime TV has just wrapped up, and as always, it was thick with liberal entertainment shows designed to brainwash Americans. At least that's according to Ben Shapiro. He is the author of the new book, Primetime Propaganda, the true Hollywood story of how the left took over your TV. Shapiro writes a syndicated column, but he's not quite like a lot of his ideological compatriots on the right. He's just 27, a Harvard Law School graduate, and he thinks, quote, television is awesome. In fact, not long ago, Ben Shapiro was asked to write a TV pilot himself.
I ended up interviewing Leonard Goldberg, who's the producer of Blue Bloods, and he was Aaron Spelling's partner. He produced Unknown last year. He and I really hit it off and said, why don't you write me a pilot? So I go out and I get a big-name agent in town. We have a meeting. Everything is going swimmingly, just terrific. About 3 weeks later, I get a call from the agent. And he says to me, Ben, I'm not sure we can represent you. And I said, okay, why is that? He said, well, we started getting your stuff out to a bunch of different producers around town. One of them liked it, but said to our agent, they ought to Google you. So one of our lower-level agents Googled you, found your website, and said, we believe that you will not be able to get work in this town because of your politics.
I'm not surprised entirely, and it is a little shocking. And I will stipulate, having read your book, that Hollywood is full of self-satisfied, annoying liberalism. And you back that up with real reporting. I'm talking to all these executives who say, yeah, we're all liberals here. But do you really think that television entertainment is mainly about liberal proselytizing?
I don't think that it's the chief goal of television to be a liberal proselytizing means. I think that the creators tend to see it as their goal to, if they can, get away with it. And I think that look, if they didn't write good entertainment, we wouldn't be talking, right? If they were just writing total liberal propaganda tripe that nobody wants to watch, then, you know, we'd be watching Public Access. But that's not what it is. I mean, they're creating really good entertainment that people want to watch, and they're just really good at sliding in their message in whatever way they feel they can.
You briefly, very briefly, mention the contradiction at the heart of Rupert Murdoch's empire, which is to say, famous conservative has created Fox News, this incredibly powerful conservative entity on the one hand, but then he creates Fox Broadcasting from its beginnings, have created what you call liberal and left-leaning shows. Doesn't it sort of prove that wherever there's money to be made, people of whatever politics will make it regardless?
I think there is some truth to that. Look, I don't think that television is a failed business model. I think that it's not a maximized business model.
But what are the left-leaning shows on Fox Broadcasting?
Family Guy, American Dad, House, Glee.
What? No, I told you this thing with you was going to be hard.
Thing with me. You mean being gay?
Yeah. Being gay. Look, I will fight to the death for your right to love whoever you want.
So you actually think that Fox and CBS and ABC and NBC are leaving money on the table by not producing what you would regard as more conservative, family-friendly programming in prime time?
100%. Not that they should dump all their liberal programming.
Right.
I just think that if you provide more balance, then you're going to hit a broader segment of the American populace. The fact is that the entire advertising industry and television industry is based around a real fallacy, which is that the 18 to 49 crowd is more valuable than anyone else. And that's why you see a tremendous shift in the industry in terms of the content from Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Petticoat Junction to Mary Tyler Moore, MASH, and All in the Family.
Well, would you disagree with what the shows you just mentioned is also a shift from kind of crappy shows to good shows?
No, I mean, I think that some of those shows are superior. I'm not a big fan of All in the Family, honestly. I think it ages very poorly.
But then Mary Tyler Moore, you talk about as a legitimization of feminism, which, yes, sure, but to the degree it was that, to the degree that I Spy putting on Bill Cosby in the early 1960s was, oh, look, a black guy can be
a lead,
competent professional, a lead. Are those bad messages to be sending?
No. I mean, I think that Mary Tyler Moore, in my opinion, went a little bit too far in the direction of a woman does not need a family, a woman does not need a husband, all a woman needs is a career and a couple of friends. You know, I don't tend to agree with that perspective too much, but was it saying something valuable about women working? Absolutely.
Exactly. That was good because it happened 30 and 40 years ago, but now, ooh, gay marriage being okay, nah, it's not so good.
Well, I mean, I don't think that the two issues are equal. I mean, what we've seen really is that over the last 40 years, liberals have achieved most of their social goals. I think there's very little doubt about that. Look, abortion is legal across the board. Gay marriage is going to become an eventuality. Look, I'm anti-gay marriage, and gay marriage is going to become an eventuality over the next 10, 15 years. And that's largely due to the influence of the popular mass media, including television.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with you that it had an influence in softening up the ground. But, I as you watch what you call liberal shows, I watched almost every episode of 24, which actually arguably had an effect on the way people thought about the legitimacy of enhanced interrogation and torture. Is there a more significant instance of entertainment programming actually having impact on policy, important policy?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that, you know, I keep going back to gay marriage, but I mean, clearly Ellen, Will, and Grace have had a much more significant impact on the discourse than I think 24 did. But I think that conservatives, as a general matter, have a tendency to go way too serious, and they tend to try and do political before funny as opposed to funny before political. By the way, conservatives are just about 20, 30 years behind the curve here. Liberals did the same thing. I think if you watch All in the Family now, it's not funny. It's political first and not funny. And I think that the cultural right has not focused their children on the entertainment industry. Instead, they've tried to teach them that Hollywood is a den of sin. And I think that that's foolishness, and I think it's counterproductive. Look, I ask the right to kind of, you know, pick up the gauntlet that the left has thrown down here.
Ben Shapiro, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ben Shapiro is the author of the new book, Primetime Propaganda, The True Hollywood Story of How the Left Took Over Your TV. And speaking of political messaging on television, if you've ever watched the animated show South Park, you know that two of the things they love satirizing are organized religion and musical theater. A couple of years ago, they did a whole musical episode about Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism.
I have, in my possession, an ancient book written on gold plates that tells of Jesus Christ's second coming, here, in America.
In America? Really? That sounds kind of...
Dum, 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 dum.
And now Trey Parker and Matt Stone have upped the stakes with a full-length Broadway musical. It's turned out to be the biggest hit of the season and the best show of the 21st century so far. It's called The Book of Mormon.
Have you heard of the All-American Prophet? The blonde-haired, blue-eyed voice of God. He didn't come from the Middle East like those other holy men. No, God's favorite prophet was All-American.
The show is up for 14 Tony Awards this weekend. It follows this odd couple of Mormon missionaries who are sent to evangelize in Uganda. It has shockingly vile jokes and nonstop profanity, but it's also got tremendous intelligence and heart. And a lot of that has to do with the composer Robert Lopez, who was best known before this for the un-PC puppet musical Avenue Q. To hear him tell it, it's almost as if working with the South Park dudes was destiny.
The South Park movie, for me, was a completely seminal experience, totally influenced me. And one thing that the musical hadn't done until the South Park movie, it had done it in pockets. It had done it at a lot of media. It had done it in the producers, the movie. And
Urinetown, I would argue.
Well, that came after.
Well, there you go.
And modern comedy of the Monty Python, Mike Nichols variety had yet to kind of penetrate musical theater until the South Park movie.
Times have changed. Our kids are getting worse. They won't obey their parents. They just want to fight and curse.
Should we blame the government or blame society?
Or should we blame the images on TV?
No, blame Canada.
Blame Canada.
With all their beady little eyes and clapping heads so full of lies.
Blame Canada.
It's sort of like a laugh-through show where comedy is an element that's integrated with the storytelling. And that was something that I was always interested in doing, and I kind of wrung my hands a bit when I saw the movie and told myself, I get sort of lit a fire under me to get working on my own stuff.
Well, one of the great songs of the many great songs in Book of Mormon is Turn It Off. Tell me how that came about.
We assumed that there would be some character that would have to deal with his gayness and suppress it.
And how does that song go? Can you play a bit?
It goes,
I got a feeling that you could be feeling a whole lot better than you feel today. You say you got a problem, well that's no problem. It's super easy not to feel that way. When you start to get confused because of thoughts in your head, don't feel those feelings. Hold them in instead. Turn it off like a light switch. Just go click. It's a cool little Mormon trick. We do it all the time when you're feeling certain feelings that just don't seem right. Treat those pesky feelings like a reading light and turn them off. Like, this is the composer tempo. I think they do it quite a bit slower.
But unlike most composers, you can actually sing.
Well, that's an overstatement, but thank you.
And on stage at the big theater, that song turns into this gigantic tap number, which is fantastic and very classic old-timey Broadway musical theater. Even as it's being the thing in a completely satisfying way, it's also parodying the thing, yeah?
I suppose. I mean, the thing about that song is that it doesn't have a lot of joy in it when you really look at the music. It's very repetitive and it's very kind of constricted and contained. And every time one of the Mormons goes into a recounting of a feeling that he's had to turn off, the music expands a little bit and gets a little bit warmer and gets a little bit realer, and then it kind of gets smacked down and it goes back into this.
No, and the very one of the brilliances of it is that very kind of willful repetitiveness of it reflects what the song's about.
Yeah, it's like Happy, Happy, Joy, Joy from Ren and Stimpy.
There you go, not, one of my favorites.
Yes, not happy really, but.
Yes, but we'll say so. What is it about Mormon missionaries that makes them and their approach to the world and who they are and how they look feel so natural when they break into song?
Well, I think there's a certain way that missionaries have to behave in order to get you interested. It's, you know, it's very much of, you know, an aggressively bright and optimistic and friendly demeanor that they present. And Mormon households are very, very sweet. Mormon kids love being at home with their families. You know, there's this thing called family home evening where they're not allowed any caffeinated drinks anyway, but they turn off the TV altogether and they play board games and they read scripture and they play musical instruments and sing and hold hands. And it sounds
short
like something.
Of the scripture and coffee, that was how I've raised my children.
That's great.
You grew up in New York City singing in churches?
Yeah,
how is that possible? Not that there aren't churches in New York City.
You know, it's weird. I went to Hunter High School. And
one of the selective public high schools in New York.
And they had just implemented this community service program where we had to do a certain number of hours in order to graduate. And the way I kind of got around having to do mine because I was lazy was to become a cantor in my neighborhood church. I basically got up and lifted my arms up and sort of sang, "The Lord be with you."
Were you a church goer?
I was because I went to Sunday school. My parents gave me that option. You know, I was exposed to this wealth of the hymnal, the Episcopal hymnal. It's the same music that Andrew Lloyd Webber grew up listening to. He's a choir boy, and it's really, really rich melodic music. And actually, a couple of those tunes found their way into the score. Even
really,
without my realizing it, the melody to Hasadiga Ibawai, the African song, which is sort of our Hakuna Matata, is very much kind of like there's a hymn that goes, "Creator of the stars at night, na 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 na." And our tune goes, "There isn't enough food to eat, Hasadiga Ibawai." You know, the element
kind of
this
Anglican reggae.
Anglican reggae. You know, they're really open, that church, so I wouldn't put it past them.
There are, throughout the show, lots and lots of allusions to other musicals, yeah? Chorus mm-hmm. Line, Music Man, Lion yeah. King.
One of the earliest ones that we did was Elder Price, when he first steps forward.
Who's the main young Mitt Romney-like leading man of the
yeah,
show.
Yeah, the super Mormon, the chiseled, good-looking one. Everyone's being assigned a location and paired up with a partner to go out on their mission, and we wanted a moment where he was picked out by the spotlight and sort of just had his little interior moment with the audience. So we kind of pulled on the I hope I get it kind of, I really need this job kind of thing.
This being, by the way, a chorus line allusion.
Yes.
So many places, where will I go on my mission? Will it be China or old Mexico on my mission?
And you kind of get the idea. It's very like bright-eyed and, God, I hope I get it.
And then he finds out it's Uganda, and they're less than thrilled.
Right.
There are jokes the first time they're made in this show make people gasp. About AIDS, about sex with babies, and so forth. Was there ever a moment when you thought, like, "Whoa, we're really going over the edge. It's going to be bad for my career"?
Well, we were talking about this baby rape thing really early in the process, and this is a real thing that you know we had researched. And you know, there was a moment where, because I had just had my first daughter had just been born, and there was one moment where I was like, you know, and then I just stopped myself. I said, let's go with this. This is going to be great. I know it's going to be great. Just put aside that whole feeling, because I know it's just going
to
work.
And it's hard for listeners who've not seen this show to imagine that such a thing isn't just horrendous and offensive. I mean, it's the description of that. It's really hard to imagine. And of course, you've done the genius. You and your collaborators done the genius of contextualizing that in a way that you don't run out of the theater horrified.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of need to see the show to understand how that could be funny.
Before Book of Mormon, you were best known for Avenue Q, which is this hugely successful musical with singing, dancing, fornicating, Muppet-like puppets.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the excellent songs from that show that now, these many years ago, caused everyone to gasp and laugh, which is called Everyone's a Little Bit Racist.
Everyone makes judgments based on race.
No, not big judgments like who to hire or who to buy a newspaper from.
No.
No, just little judgments like thinking that Mexican busboys should learn to speak goddamn English.
Right.
Everyone's a little bit racist today. So everyone's a little bit racist. Okay. Ethnic jokes might
this
be
sort of cheerful, shockingly honest and un-PC, but still redemptive vision. Is that Bobby Lopez?
Well, I like to use music in ways that aren't necessarily expected. You know, you sort of use the sunniness of music or the sadness of music in a way that it hasn't been used before. And I think that's the only real territory left to be original in musical theater. It's not It's not constructing melodies that have never been heard before. It's not even finding music that the audience hasn't heard before to bring into a musical situation. It's using music in a way that's unexpected. And I that's what I try and do no matter whether it's for funny or for serious.
Do you now have a dream idea of, oh, I want to work with this person?
Well, I'm in the middle of a couple of projects. I have a movie coming out actually this summer that I did with my wife, who's a songwriter too, and it's one of the Disney movies that's coming out.
What is it?
Winnie the Pooh.
Really?
Yeah. It's coming out on the same day as Harry Potter. So see it the next day.
And is this a retelling with vile jokes of the Winnie the Pooh story?
No, it's one for the kids. It's definitely, it's for kids that are so young that all the jokes in Book of Mormon would go over their head.
Well, congratulations.
Thanks.
Bobby Lopez, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
The Book of Mormon is up for 14 Tony Awards and, in my opinion, deserves to win pretty much every one.
Gee, thank you. That's so sweet. Thank you.
Will you play I Believe so we can go out on that?
Sure.
Ever since I was a child, I've tried to be the best. So what happened? My family and friends all said I was blessed. So what happened? It was supposed to be all so exciting to be teaching of Christ across the sea, but I allowed my faith to be shaken. Oh, what's the matter with me? I've always longed to help the needy, to do the things I've never dared. This was the time for me to step up, so then why was I so scared? A warlord who shoots people in the face, what's so scary about that? I've got a Lord who is mightier, who always has my back. Now I must be completely devout. I can't have even one shred of doubt. I believe that the Lord God created the universe. I believe that He sent His only Son to die for my sins. Ancient Jews built boats and sailed to America. I am a Mormon.
That was Bobby Lopez, the composer of the Book of Mormon. We've got a video of Bobby playing live for us at studio360.org. It has been a big year on Broadway, from unqualified hits like Book of Mormon to the debacle and reinvention of Spider-Man. But one of the season's most ambitious and singular shows is playing off-Broadway. We are about to step inside maybe the most unusual, fantastical take on Macbeth ever produced.
We're trying to do the opposite to the formulaic conventions of going to the theatre, where Right. Everybody knows what the rules are, and so therefore you're completely passive about it. We want them to not know what's going on. You need to have that sense of mild threat and adrenaline of the unknown.
Something Wicked This Way comes in just a minute on Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Studio 360, enjoy your stay at the McKittrick.
So I stepped into this big old building in Chelsea, one of New York's artier neighborhoods, that everybody has been buzzing about. On the wall outside is a normal-looking sign. It says McKittrick Hotel. Inside, the lounge looks like it's out of the 1930s.
What can I get for you, sir?
I'm actually here to see a play. It's a production by a British company called Punch Drunk. But no one will tell me exactly what's about to happen, other than it's loosely based on Macbeth. The show is called Sleep No More.
Please down your cocktails, because you can't bring them with you. Please step right over here. Thank you.
The theater company Punch Drunk are pioneers in immersive theater. What they've done is take 100,000 square feet of warehouse space, 2.5 acres, and turned it into this meticulously detailed world, a kind of Macbeth theme park with no signage or maps or instructions.
These are your masks for this evening.
I'm handed a mask, white plastic, sinister looking, like out of the movie Eyes Wide Shut. The elevator goes up, and then at level 3, the doors open. And I'm inside a living room. It's dimly lit, atmospheric. The walls are lined with mirrors and faded photographs of children. I walk through a doorway and then stumble into a graveyard, real dirt crunching beneath my feet. I round the corner and now I'm in a bedroom, and there's a man and woman dancing, this passionate, almost violent duet. Nobody speaks, but I believe I've found Mr. and Mrs. Macbeth. I leave them and step into a dark courtyard that's draped in fog.
Now we're in the grounds of the hotel, and it's sort of decaying Victorian walled garden.
That is the show's creator, 33-year-old Felix Barrett, who seems more like Puck from Midsummer Night's Dream than anybody out of Macbeth.
The disease and rot that's at the core of their relationship becomes evident out here. It's Lady Macbeth's playground, beautifully indicative of Blackheart.
For as long as I want, 45 minutes, an hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever, I will follow Lady Macbeth or the other characters around their dreamy world. It's a giant-sized theatrical version of Choose Your Own Adventure. It's intensively imagined and truly mysterious.
For me, it's most important that audience members feel like they're lost. Almost that moment of panic where you think, am I in the right place? Have I strayed too far?
Yes, I was lost most of the time, so you succeeded.
The original challenge with this was, how do we do the full Macbeth, but you don't hear any of the language. The language gets absorbed into the space, into the intention, but ultimately it's a silent film.
Yes. How many floors do you have here?
There are six floors.
Really? And 100,000 square feet in all?
Yeah. But some of the spaces not everyone can access. The sixth floor, you can only get in if you're by yourself.
Really?
You're very lucky. Fate will have a hand in that.
Interesting.
So
it's New York. Of course there's a VIP room.
Yeah.
lead the way.
Come through here. So here we are in the foyer, the lobby of the McKittrick Hotel.
Suggested by old phone booths and old furniture. And
It's slightly run down. It's almost half it's been locked up for the winter.
Do you have a year in mind that we are in during the show?
1938. Sort of, you know, the peak of film noir.
Yeah.
And we're in Scotland.
And this is inspired by Macbeth and a take on Macbeth. And we don't have any problem, unlike a regular theater where you can't say Macbeth, we don't say the Scottish play.
Well, very interesting. We actually actively embrace it because I think one of our big design concepts for the whole building, all 100 rooms, is that...
100 rooms, really?
Yeah, is that superstition for us is at the core of the text. And the idea that these portents and omens are in the air. And, you know, there's witchcraft and, you know, the dark arts are everywhere. So every single space has some sort of superstition within it. Either it's something that's preventative and it's almost like it wards off evil and protects against witches, which means that our witches can't actually enter. Or it's something that's a curse. It's almost the hex upon the space that's actually sucking the darkness in.
And now when you come here at night during a performance, there were people eating lunch or breakfast or whatever they're doing, and then start to interact in these strange, choreographed, silent ways.
Yeah, the action is largely contemporary dance.
And it's improvised?
Actually nothing in the show is improvised.
Really?
At 8:05 every evening, we'll know exactly where everyone is in the building.
Really?
Yeah.
So all the embraces and climbing up walls and all the rest, that's...
Totally so. Every single gesture, every single action has been rehearsed.
So we've seen two of 100 rooms. Let's go see some
let's
more.
Let's go upstairs too. So this is Lady Macbeth's bedroom in the orangery, sort of the most exclusive, luxurious wing of the hotel. Grand bed, it's the marital suite. The key scene here probably is the persuasion. You know, it's her actually forcing him to do the deed.
And by the way, an old-fashioned bathtub full of what looks to be bloody water.
Yeah, the water at the top of the show starts clean, but after murdering Duncan, The water's very red by the end. So now we've just walked through the vegetable patch that's in the grounds of the
McKitchen. It seems to be a graveyard.
Well, it kind of, yeah, it's half
piles
graveyard.
Of dirt with crosses, I'd say graveyard. But.
Yeah. And here, we're now in the guardsman's cottage
on
the estate. And this is the home of the Macduffs.
This begins one of these smaller domestic spaces that is so intensely decorated with objects, books and flowers and teacups and crucifixes, and I could go on and on. People, audience members, can and do go examine individual things and pull a book off the shelf, and that's okay, right?
Yeah, it's crucial that if you want to, you can go up and scrutinize. And actually, if we move down here, there are sort of every single drawer that you see, you can open and you can interrogate. Right? You would open these drawers. So there's a black and white photograph of an infant in a circle of salt with the character of Lady Macduff. Her mild paranoia about her infants has turned into borderline lunacy.
And here on the wall are dozens of really old, yellowed newspaper magazine clippings pinned to the wall, along with religious artifacts, photographs. I mean, the density of material and choice made about why is this text here and what does this mean? Yeah. And does it mean anything?
Yeah, we've got a huge team of people led by Beatrice Minns who work on the detail, from letter writing to sourcing these right quotes. So these actual Bible references that are used as preventative charms. What's this one? St. Christopher, that his mercies might instruct the Christ in my heart to open heavenwards and receive thy spirit, for to know in the unity of the saints the love. And that's all we get. That's a scrap. Should we go upstairs?
Sure,
hospital?
Whatever you say. So here we're in the one of the more clearly spooky places, a hospital ward, an asylum ward, something that has a crucifix over each plain, depressing white metal bed.
And this is where, when Lady Macbeth goes mad and is driven crazy by the actions, she ends up and spends the last of her days.
Because there are 100,000 different versions of this, of Sleep No More, that can be experienced, I know I've had conversations with every friend of mine who I've discovered has seen it, saying, "Oh, did you see this? Or what did you do there? And did you see that?" And so comparing notes. But I've also seen that there are people online trying to amass their knowledge in a kind of wiki way. Does that bug you?
Actually, it does. It's very strange. That's the only difference between an American audience and an English audience. That I think here there's a sense that it's a puzzle that can be solved, and they're trying to work out the logic so that you could almost create a sort of master plan which we have, you know, at 8:05, Lady Macduff will be in the ballroom with a candlestick. And there's a desire for people to make sense of that.
Yeah.
When I think it's an English audience, strangely, it's almost go the other way, and they just...
They don't want to demystify anything.
They don't want to demystify, yeah.
Well, thank you, Felix. This is fantastic.
Thank you very much.
I hope you run for as long as you want to run.
Thanks. Pleasure.
Good.
Pleasure indeed.
Sleep No More is playing in New York City through the summer. You can see some of the rooms we visited at studio360.org. Coming up,
one bad night, I'll hold the glass until the glass.
The Antlers shook up the rock music world with their old-fashioned concept album about death and dying. And then they had to write a sequel.
There's no way you can predict how people are going to react to something you write, and all you could do is try and be honest with it.
The Antlers play from their new album, Burst Apart. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Don't go away.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We really like hearing about the works of art and entertainment that have changed your lives. Susan Evans listened to the show in New Mexico, but she grew up in rural Louisiana during the 1950s and 60s. Her first year of high school was also the first year of federally enforced integration in her town, and that didn't sit well with her parents. Heads up to our listeners, Susan's father used the standard slur of that time and place to refer to black people.
And I can remember my father would walk into my bedroom and see that my television was turned on to the Jeffersons. And he would say, "I don't want you watching those niggers on TV." And he would turn my TV off. So it was just a great deal of anger and difficulty with my family at that time.
Susan says that she was never comfortable with her family's casual racism, but she had a hard time finding the courage to stand up to it. Years later, when Susan was living on her own, once again she was watching TV one night and came across an old black and white movie from 1947, Elia Kazan's Gentleman's Agreement.
I was watching Turner Classic Movies, and there it was. It really addresses all sorts of prejudice, but the central theme in this particular movie is anti-Semitism. Gregory Peck plays Philip Green, who is a famous or a very highly respected writer. So he goes undercover and actually pretends to be Jewish so that he can experience firsthand the anti-Semitism. Well, the romantic subplot that's going on is that he meets Dorothy McGuire, and it's just a wonderful match, and you love them. But she is very WASP, and she's from Connecticut and Darien, and there are some very closed societies up there and lots of restricted country clubs.
It's detestable, but that's the way it is. It's even worse in New Canaan. There, nobody can sell or rent to a Jew. And even in Darien, where Jane's house is and my house is, there's sort of a gentleman's agreement when you get
gentlemen's. Kathy, you can't. You're not going to fight it, Kathy. You're just going to give in, play along, let their idiotic rules stand.
I don't play along. But what can one person do?
You can tell them to go jump in the lake.
And I think it was really just a subject that was always on my mind at the time. So when I watched Gentleman's Agreement, I realized that answers a problem for me, and it's definitely not going to be easy, but I have got to have a conversation with my family. And every time I would go home, there would be a dinner or people sitting around visiting just the family. And they would immediately start in with the jokes about the blacks and the gays and women. And many, many times I would just get up, I would quietly just leave the room. It was protecting me from them, but it wasn't changing anything.
Oh, I hate it, I hate it, I hate everything about this horrible thing. They always make trouble for everybody, even their friends. They force people to take sides against them.
Quit that. They didn't suggest this series. They didn't give me the angle. They haven't got a single thing to do with what's happened between you and me.
Shout at me. And don't treat me to any more lessons of tolerance. I'm sick of it.
So Kathy, after the really bad fight, calls Dave Goldman, and he was in the army with Gregory Peck's character.
Do you think I'm anti-Semitic?
So they have this meeting in a restaurant.
No, Kathy, I don't.
Phil does.
Does he?
You know I'm not anti-Semitic. You're a Jew and you know it. Why can I make it clear to everybody but Phil?
And she is just kind of trying to pour her heart out and express her confusion, how she can't understand. She's on the same side as him. She doesn't understand what he wants.
Well, it was just a vulgar little joke that a man told at dinner. It has nothing to do with
this. Take it easy, Kathy. Maybe it has.
Oh, all right. It was a man named Lockhart, and he tried to get laughs with words like kike and coon, and I despised him and everybody else.
What did you do, Kathy, when he told the joke?
What do you mean?
I mean, what did you say when he finished?
I wanted to yell at him. I wanted to get up and leave. I wanted to say to everyone at that table, why do we sit here and take it when he's attacking everything that we believe in? Why don't we call him on it?
And what did you do?
I just sat there. I felt ashamed. We all just sat there.
Oh, I just love that.
Yeah.
That is definitely the scene that woke me up. When she suddenly realized what she had to do, that was the same moment that I realized what I had to do. all I did was at dinner one day, I looked down at my plate and I said, I don't think that's funny. And then instead of just walking away, I went on to say, I'm just not going to laugh at these kind of jokes anymore. I work with gay people. I work with blacks. These are my friends. They're wonderful human beings, and I'm just not going to participate in this anymore. The dinner just completely stopped when I said those words, quiet enough that you could have heard a pin drop. And I just had the feeling that suddenly I had the floor. And it was such a quiet little moment. It passed. We finished our dinner. It was what happened later that was really significant to me, and that was privately, one by one, my siblings would come to me and tell me that they really didn't harbor those deep prejudices. They did begin to respect me more, and I noticed a drastic decrease in that kind of discussion when we would get together after that. You know, it is a pretty nervy thing to do, but I just knew after watching that movie, I knew I didn't have any choice. It was an epiphany. Finding the answer was right there all along in this film that was released in 1947.
You know something, Phil? I suddenly want to live to be very old. Very. I want to be around to see what happens.
A good film can change the world. This is what the movie did for me. And I'm grateful.
Wouldn't it be wonderful, Phil, if it turned out to be everybody's century? When people all over the world, free people, found a way to live together. I'd like to be around to see some of that, even the beginning.
Susan Evans is a painter in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where she listens to the show on KANW. Studio 360's Derek John produced our story. Is there some movie or book or other work of art that rocked your world? We want to hear about it at studio360.org. We all know that the album died a long time ago, right? Especially in this digital downloading age. It's all about singles. So it's a little surprising and, to people my age, heartening when young musicians put out concept albums where each song is meant to be a piece of a bigger whole. Like Hospice, the 2009 album by the band The Antlers.
But something kept me standing by that hospital bed. I should have quit, but instead I took
The main storyline is about coming to terms with the death of a friend. But the music isn't what you'd expect from that. It's not morose and spare. It's big and lush, and was one of the year's most critically acclaimed albums. The Antlers have lightened up some, subject-wise, but their new album, Burst Apart, is still rich and complex. And here with me now is Peter Silberman, the band's leader. Peter, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Burst Apart isn't exactly happy-go-lucky, but it's not as dark as Hospice was. How intentional was that shift?
I think it was mostly the intent with the record was to make something honest and to make something that was indicative of where we were at that point in time that we were recording it and writing it. You know, to force something as bleak and dismal as Hospice, I think, would have just, I don't know, felt unnatural.
Did the effect that it had on listeners make you think, oh, I at least I've got to do that again somehow?
I think at first I was a little bit worried about that, but when I considered the idea of trying to produce that effect again, it seemed really, really false. And there's no way you can predict how people are going to react to something you write, and all you could do is try and be honest with it. I feel really connected to this record just in a very different way, where it doesn't necessarily remind me of very difficult times. It just, you know, it's confusing times,
right?
And it's a conflicted record.
Yeah. Well, you're 24. Why shouldn't you be confused?
Exactly.
Will you play a song?
Sure will.
And what's this going to be?
It's going to be called I Don't Want Love.
Great.
Thank you.
That was The Antlers performing I Don't Want Love from their new album. And Peter Silverman, could you introduce the other members of The Antlers?
Sure. You've got Michael Lerner on the drums, Darby Seesai on keyboards and synthesizer, and Timmy Mislock on guitar.
You also, as we just heard, have a very impressive upper range vocal ability.
Thanks.
Is that just how you felt most natural singing, or did you just listen to a lot of Journey and Bee Gees as a kid?
I think it was just a result of doing a lot of home recording for a while and recording in places where I kind of needed to record quietly and wasn't going to sing very loudly.
Really?
So I was singing really quietly, and I think the easiest way for me to do that was in an upper register. So I just kept doing it.
That's interesting. Now, as you were growing up, were there any specific albums or books that sort of hit you and influenced you as a writer?
Yeah, I mean, there was, as far as books, I think Raymond Carver's short stories influenced a lot of the lyrics that I've written. And musically, it's kind of all over the place. You know, there were things like Neutral Milk Hotel a long time ago, and not so much anymore. And now it's more in the realm of like Bob Dylan kind of things. But
Raymond Carver makes a lot of sense.
Thanks.
There are several songs on this album that have references to dogs. And in fact, the deluxe edition of this album has a little pet tag that comes with it, which is reason enough to buy it. what is it with you and dogs?
It just worked its way in there. I'm definitely like a dog lover and grew up with dogs, but I think it just worked its way into the lyrics as kind of as a metaphor for certain kinds of people, ways that you treat other people and the way people treat you.
And in a good way or a bad way?
Yeah, I think it could be good or bad. I think in some ways it's sort of like a dog that you take pity on or want to like take care of. And I think the idea is to not treat people that way.
Right. But real dogs you like.
Of course.
Peter Silverman and The Antlers, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And before you go, you're going to play another song.
Yeah.
In fact, called Hounds.
That's right.
Take it away.
All right.
The Antlers' new album is called Burst Apart, and you can hear more music and see a video of them performing live for us at studio360.org. While you're there, you can subscribe to our free podcast of the show and follow the show and me on Twitter at studio360show and at KB Anderson. And that's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Michael Guerriero,
Sarah D'Elia,
Sean Twigg,
Rachel Greenberg,
Katie Bierenbaum.
Special thanks this week to Ed Haber, and thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI. Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
Many people ask the question whether those paramecia feel pain or not.
A new video game lets you play Pac-Man with living organisms.
You now have to try as a player to move your paramecia such to collect all these dots.
We'll give it a beta test with a champion gamer. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.